I'm Andrew Ramsamy, and this is the Global Sport Matters podcast. Sport at the college level in America is facing issues reflective of the world at large, from calls for racial equality to labor disputes and discussions to health and safety concerns with players playing in a pandemic. What will this reset moment look like? Well, Global Sport Matters has just dropped its latest issue on the reset of college sport. To learn more about it, be sure to visit our website at globalsportmatters.com. And now, the show. In college sport, football may reign supreme in popularity, but it is behind the curve when it comes to diversity at its top-tier coaching positions. In the newest field study report to come out from the Global Sport Institute, it shows a stark yet unsurprising reality of hiring of Division I head coaches over the past decade in the NCAA Power Five. Joining me to discuss his investigation into our field study is reporter Patrick Hruby. Patrick has covered everything from politics to pop culture to the economy and back again. But he's always had an affinity for sports and how it forms perfect intersections with societal issues. Patrick spoke to Black coaches, many whose credentials include PhDs and Super Bowl rings, which apparently isn't enough to be a head coach. This is the Global Sport Matters podcast. I'm Andrew Ramsamy. Today on the show, Patrick Hruby and his reporting, too few Black college coaches, too few opportunities. So joining me now is Patrick Hruby. Patrick has written an article for us about some research that the Global Sport Institute has done looking at the NCAA and the Power Five. Patrick, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
So Patrick, for people who don't know who you are, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been working on these last couple of months during COVID.
So I am a longtime journalist, I guess largely a sports journalist, although in my long career, it's weird to say it's long now. I've covered politics, I've covered pop culture, I've covered culture at large, kind of a little bit of everything. And even in sports, you know, I've gone from covering who wins, who loses, who's good, who's bad, big events like the Olympics, the Final Four, national championships, to covering all sorts of off-field issues. That's probably what I've done the most of in the last decade, is all the places where sports and society intersect, all the places where you do not just stick to sports. So we're talking about sports and race, sports and the economy, sports and culture, sports and the law. Basically, to me, where all the action really is. And I think it's honestly a really fascinating, a really intriguing, really rewarding place to be. I say that with a little bit of air quotes, because there's no way that's that rewarding in journalism right now. But in terms of
journalism is crumbling. It's on fire.
Yeah, a little bit, like a lot of things right now. But what I like about that, and what I like about stuff like the Global Sport Institute does, is that sports is such a mirror of society. And there's so many things that if you could understand it in sports or through sports, you actually can get an understanding of how it works everywhere else, because sports are not separated off in the sports page. You know, sports are a part of everything. So in the NCAA, if you can understand what's going on with college athletes, their economic rights, the fight over amateurism, you can understand what's happening with Uber and their drivers, or understand what's happening with labor and management in general in this country, or what's even happened with antitrust law in the last 30 years. You could actually learn a lot through college sports, which sounds ridiculous, but it's totally true. What we're going to talk about later today, the barriers that people of color face trying to become a head football coach in the Power Five, actually, those barriers have a lot in common with the barriers that people of color face all across America in all sorts of different career areas. So, I mean, I just think it's a great way, especially also for readers out there who maybe will never learn about this stuff in another way. Sports is a way to bring them in and teach them something valuable and important, and just open their minds to more of how the world works, which to me is just, that's great. What more could you ask for as a journalist?
And what particularly about sport attracts you to want to talk about it and report on it?
Look, I like everybody. I grew up like enjoying sports, like enjoying watching it. There's so much human drama that's really just engaging and enjoyable. And B, seeing people who are incredible at something is really engaging. Like, I covered the Athens Olympics, and sitting there at the track, the 100-meter final, and these are like the fastest humans on the planet, all in one place, and you're going to watch them be faster than anybody else on the planet. Like, that's kind of amazing. Like, seeing sort of peak human performance is kind of inspiring, and just sort of, you know, you don't get that every day, right? It's just kind of like, I think that's one of the reasons we all like sports, is seeing people do incredible things. And also, like I said, it's a really, because sports is so fun and so engaging in so many ways, it's a little bit of an ice cream method of then using that to bring people to things that are maybe hard to understand, not so fun, but really important. So again, like a lot of the things that happen off the field in sports or outside the lines that aren't good, that reflect these larger sort of social problems we have, political problems, economic problems, the fact that sports is something that everybody kind of, or lots of people can kind of enjoy and engage with, it's a way to bring people into those problems and again, help open their eyes in a way that just a straight news story about that thing might not work, because the person might look at that and be like, you know what, I've had a long enough day. I've seen enough bad news today. I don't need it anymore. This doesn't seem like this really engaged me. Sports can be a little bit of a backdoor into that.
So let's set the frame for what we're going to talk about today. So the Global Sport Institute produced a field study specifically looking at the Power Five in the NCAA and head football coaching positions at D1 schools. All of that research and all of that data was kind of compiled together. And then we kind of handed that data off to you. We didn't tell you what to do with it. We said, take this, run, you know, kind of kept our editorial firewall, not kept, we did. We had an editorial firewall between the Institute and Global Sport Matters and what you're writing mm-hmm. for us. But when you got that initial set of data and research from the Global Sport Institute, what was your first impression?
Well, my first impression was, okay, A, I had seen this kind of work done repeatedly over the years with the NFL, right? People have looked at the issue and the problem in the NFL for a while, including, by the way, even the NFL, it's such a problem that even the NFL itself has actually gone to outside researchers to look at this too, which is like not what they usually always do. And the problem of coaches of color facing a lot of barriers to career advancement. So becoming a head coach, even becoming a coordinator, just rising up through the ranks of starting as a player and ending up as a coach, a head coach in a position of power, authority. It's more difficult for a bunch of reasons for people of color than for white people. That's been somewhat looked at in college sports, and it's certainly been pointed out in college sports, but there's not as many times where people have systemically looked at it. And I thought, especially with the study at ASU, it was being looked at the Power Five, which is like the upper echelon, right? That is the creme de la creme, the top of college football. So those are the head coaching positions that have the most authority, the most, you know, financial reward attached to it, the most prestige, the most visible. That's where if you are white, black, Latino, any young coach of any ambition, that's where you want to end up if you're trying to like climb the career ladder in college sports. And to see it looked at over 10 years and also the last 10 years. So we're not talking about going back to like the 1950s when America is like segregated by law and these schools are segregated. We're not talking about the 1980s. We're not talking about the 1990s. We're talking about this last decade where, you know, in a lot of ways for real and also a lot of ways theoretically, like we're a lot more advanced in society. Like we're a lot more integrated. We're a lot more, there's a lot more equality, right? The idea, it should be, you know, we shouldn't really have too many of these barriers anymore in college sports. But we do. That's what this study showed. It showed that still in the 2010s, coaches of color are climbing uphill compared to their white counterparts when it comes to getting to these jobs. The numbers just bear that out. The numbers show that. The study didn't provide any it says explicitly in the study, you know, we don't know why. We can't explain exactly why. We're showing the phenomenon. We're showing you that it suggests that there are these barriers. And so to me as a reporter, you know, you get a study like that and your first question is, okay, what is the why? Why is this still the case? What isn't changing that needs to change? What could be done? You know, I had all these questions instantly. You know, I want to take that data and I want to explore it. You know, and in some ways, that's the thing you can't do by sort of, you can't look at 10 years of data and figure out the why. You have to go out and talk to people. You have to go research. You have to try to put together the historical context, the modern context, and just sort of paint a picture of what's really happening. So to me, that was a great opportunity, and I was really excited to do that.
So as you started to go out there and you started to talk to folks, who were some of the people that you started talking to, and what did they say?
So the interesting thing is, and thank God, it's like there are people out there that have been studying this for a long time. And also not only studying it, but have been actively lived it and studied it. The person I found that was the most interesting for this is a guy named Fitz Hill. And he was the first African-American head coach at San Jose State University back in the 2000s. He later became a university president. He wrote a book in 2012 called Crackback that is all about this phenomenon of African-American football coaches being stymied in terms of their career advancement and climbing the ladder and getting to those head coaching jobs. And what was so fascinating is that Fitz is not just, so he's a super thoughtful, super, super thoughtful guy, but he's not just someone who lived this in his own coaching career. As he was coaching from his days as a graduate assistant coach onward, he was studying this in an academic way. He was literally like sending out, he was one of the first people to do this, he was sending out surveys to African-American and white assistant coaches in the NCAA, like to hundreds of coaches, polling them about this topic, like getting their attitudes, like learning like what they thought about it. Like he was doing research on like how many coaches are there and how do they move up. I mean, he was doing all this kind of work from like the 1990s on, like groundbreaking work. You know, a couple of other people who work in academia, sociologists, have also looked at this issue over the years. They've written research papers. They've done some of the same stuff. But Fitz was an African-American coach trying to rise up in coaching and was doing this like on the side as part of his academics. I mean, that's incredible. You don't often find like someone who is like, you know, it's like the whole Hair Club for Men joke, right? I'm a member, I'm also the president. Like it was, so he had like an incredible perspective on this because he could talk about it as a researcher and talk about someone who lived it and saw it firsthand. I mean, some of the stories he told me about his career were just, you know, they were heartbreaking, but also really illustrative of the barriers that Black coaches, Latino coaches faced and still face. And that was one of the things that came across in talking to Fitz when I shared some of this data with him. You know, he wrote his book in 2012. A lot of the information in his book was based on the stuff he collected from the 90s onward. His coaching experience, you know, ended in the mid-2000s. I think he went into just being a university administrator. And he told me, you know, it's almost 10 years later from when I'm writing my book. I thought after I did my book, we wouldn't still be talking about this. And yet here you are calling me and we're still talking about the same problem. So that was disheartening to be sure.
And then you spoke to people like Richard Lapchick, who's been, mm-hmm. you know, again, studying this. It seems to be that there's a common thing that a lot of people have been studying this issue.
Right.
Reporting on this issue, documenting it, you know, putting it down on paper. Did you catch any glimpses of what perhaps might be some internal motivations to move this issue forward?
Well, you know, I mean, I think so. Someone like Fitz, I think obviously is motivated because it's something he lived, right? He lived it. Other African-American coaches he knew and knows lived it. I mean, I think there's a lot of motivation there. But someone like Richard Lapchick, like, he is a longtime, you know, civil rights advocate in general, but especially focused on sports. I think it's just something he's passionate about. He really cares about. He's got an incredible biography. And you go back in time and it's like, I think he started on this when he got, like, as a teenager, he was like friends with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Lou Alcindor at the time, and got into like a fist fight, like defending Kareem from like racist white dudes, basically. I think if you go back, like that's kind of like the story. I think he might still have like a scar from that or something.
Yes, that is the story.
Yeah. So there's like, I mean, he's like someone who's been like down with this cause for a long time. But I mean, even one of the research papers that I looked into was, there's a guy, his name is Eli Kenock. I'm probably pronouncing his last name. He's an assistant like coach at Duke football right now, like a young white guy, and he did like his one of his like, I think it might have been his master's thesis on this. Like he did a big research paper on this, and you could see almost reading his. Like he did all the numerical breakdowns. He looked at a whole season of college football, and you could almost feel like reading it. You could almost feel him getting more and more pissed off as he realized, like, wow, like African American coaches are still getting a raw deal right now, like in the 2010s. You know, so it was like when I was learning those schools, like it wasn't like it was just I went out and talked to black people who had lived this and were upset about this, but like a lot of white people too, who didn't feel like this was right either, and were also trying to understand this. And so I felt, I mean, I just feel like the motivations that I found for this, I mean, it sounds corny, but like they were very pure. Like these are people who none of them, you know, it's like the purest people who worked on who have worked and did work and are working in civil rights were like, they just want it to be a more equitable world, a more equitable field. They want, in this case, college football. But just in general, these are people who don't want to see opportunity denied for a variety of reasons that we have not totally addressed or overcome yet as a society.
So let's talk about qualifications. Mm-hmm. One of the people that you spoke to had a pretty large, substantial, highly impressive qualification, and was not considered good enough to lead. Tell us about this person and this qualification that apparently wasn't good enough to become a head coach.
I'm a little bit, you have to give me a little bit of hint here. I feel like that was the story of quite a few people I looked at historically.
Someone who won a Super Bowl.
Oh, right. So this is kind of, when I say this, I don't mean it in a good way. This is kind of a classic story of what the problem is here. So Doug Williams, right, who was a Super Bowl winning quarterback with the Washington football team. I live in DC, so I didn't live here at the time, but I mean, I still remember that. That was a big groundbreaking moment. But, you know, he played pro football for a long time. He was a college superstar at Grambling. And then he went back to college coaching. He led Grambling to like 3 state titles in its conference, like was an accomplished college coach. And he didn't just start there. He started in high school, right, in Louisiana, worked his way up through college coaching. So paid his dues. It wasn't like he just walked into a head job somewhere like a Steve Nash or something like that. You know, he did what you're supposed to do. After a great playing career. This is back in 2002. He was one of the finalists for the head coaching job at University of Kentucky, right? So Southeastern Conference at the time had never had an African-American head football coach. 2002, that's a long time since integration. But on the other hand, it's a Southeastern Conference. That's like probably like the most segregated part of the country at the time when it was segregated. So like, you could kind of understand that maybe the SEC would come to the table a little late with something like that. Just historically, it makes a little more sense. It's not good, but you can understand it. And ultimately, the job went to this guy, Rich Brooks, who had been a coach at Oregon and a coach at the NFL. Again, a qualified white guy, right? And the thing that really stuck in Doug Williams' craw, and he talked to Fitz Hill about this. He actually wrote the intro to Fitz Hill's book, so he breaks the story down even better in there, is the Kentucky's athletic director said, you know, we just didn't have a, quote, comfort level with you. There was a comfort factor that was missing. And this kind of, again, Doug writes about this. It kind of drove him nuts. And he said to Fitz Hill, he said, what do you mean by comfort? Does that mean you don't want to drink tea with me? Which is like the thing of like, it's got to be maddening. Look, it's hard for any of us when we're like a finalist for a job we really want and don't get it. But like, if you're black and you know all these barriers exist and you know, like, wow, I might be the first African-American coach in 2002 in a whole college football conference. Like not only is that something you're shooting for because you want to break that barrier, but also like, you know, that means there are barriers to break. Right. And then you just get this sort of like, it just wasn't a comfort factor. How could you not walk away and be like, well, is it because I'm black? Is it because of my race? Is it because of this history of racial discrimination we have? Like, you can never really know or not know what it is exactly. And I think in some ways, I'm not African-American myself, but if I put myself into someone's shoes, I feel, and from talking to people, I feel like that feeling is almost as corrosive or maybe even more corrosive than like having the door slammed in your face and it says whites only. Like in some ways, it's almost worse to have to wonder than to just know, okay, well, this is just like straight up prejudice, you know, and I'm just going to have to find a way to like defeat this. But now it's just kind of like, is it still prejudice? Is it not? What did I do wrong? It leaves you sort of not knowing what to do. And one of the things interesting with Doug is that he basically was like, you know what? College coaching, man, like this, I don't want to have to deal with this. He went back to the NFL after that. And that was a big reason why. He just didn't want to have to deal with that feeling. He went into front office management in the NFL, not even coaching. And I think, look, for a guy that has such a good qualifications, we talked about this at the start of your question, right? And who had such a good career and was so promising, had done really well in the coaching he had done, that's a loss for the coaching profession potentially. Not just for Kentucky, but like, we don't know, like Doug Williams, for all we know, could have ended up being a really good college coach and producing a really good college football teams and college football product for all of you out there that loves college football. So that's a potential loss. And that's the thing why everybody should care about this. Even if you're the person out there who loves college football and you absolutely don't care about racial equity, and I hate to say that there are people out there like that, you should care about racial equity because it means you're losing out potential talent to make the thing you love better and getting the best people regardless of color in there doing it. And that's, you know, with Doug Williams, we're never going to know what he could have been as a college coach. And we're going to miss out on having found out. And that means we could have missed out on some really good college football.
And a disproportionate amount of college athletes, especially in football, are Black. Mm-hmm. What do you think it means for college players to have, you know, played in the game, played in the system, to then look up and go, oh, but all the people at the top who run these programs, who are coaches of these programs, that for the most part, the majority of them are white men?
That's a great question. And I think that it is detrimental to them. I think that it's detrimental to, and by the way, this is not just coaching. This is true of athletic administration in college sports too, which is overwhelmingly white. This is true of athletic directors, their staff, university presidents, all the other people in positions of authority. You know, I talked to, this wasn't in some of the stuff I wrote for GSI, but in the interviews I did, I talked to an African-American athletic director who had been a college basketball player at USC. And he talked about how much it meant, George Raveling was his coach back at USC, who was also African-American. He talked about how much it meant to him to have a Black coach, to see a Black man like in that position of authority, right? And that position of power. And what it meant just for him in terms of being, a 20-year-old guy who's like pretty focused right now on being good at basketball, trying to see if he could like play some professional basketball. But to think to himself, you know, there could be more for me out there than just that. Because look, I see someone that looks like me in that kind of position. Now he's an athletic director. Like that's invaluable. Look, when we're young, we're all looking for role models. We're all looking for people we can see and imagine ourselves in their position someday or doing something similar or be inspired by. And you don't have to be inspired by someone of your own race, but it doesn't hurt. It can only really help. And especially, look, if you're Black and you know growing up in this society that there's still all these barriers because you experience them every day, knowing that there are people that knock them down, that accomplish stuff anyway, that did it despite those barriers, how much hope does that give you? So how much hope have we stolen from generations of young Black men by not having more Black men and women in these positions of authority and power and decision-making and the positions that are ultimately aspirational?
So the reporting that you did for us was so huge that we decided to break it down into three stories.
Story of my career.
Yeah. Well, and it was a good thing we were in a situation of saying, we're going to have to edit that, cut that out. No, we're actually going to use all of it. Mm-hmm. But in the series, which then leads to number three, you talk to Sam Sachs, a white man and a white player who kind of saw this happening right before his eyes, like unfolding before his eyes, and then made it his mission to change the game. And talk about what happened when he decided to take on that mission.
So Sam Sachs was one of the coolest guys I talked to in this, because Back in the beginning, we talked about people's motivations. I mean, here's a guy whose motivation is just 100% like, I see something's wrong and I want to make a difference. Like, there's no financial gain for him. It's not his own line of work. It's literally just like, I'm looking at society. That's BS. And I'm not going to let it stand. And it's like, it's that anyone who's like that to me is super inspiring, right? So Sam is a guy who at one point he was, I think he was a juvenile corrections like guard who decided to go back to college, get his degree. He got his degree in Black Studies at Portland State University. While he's there, this is in the late 2000s, Portland State hires Jerry Glanville as its football coach. Jerry Glanville, the old, like he was the Atlanta Falcons NFL coach like in the 1990s, like been around football for a long time. I mean, totally qualified, but kind of like a retread guy. But Sam had been, while he was studying at Portland State, he had been contacting the athletic department being like, you know, yo, when you hire coaches, people of authority, just interview at least one qualified minority candidate, please. Like, don't just interview white people or just hire white people. At least, like, bring someone of color in to talk to. Like, he wasn't asking for a lot, but he's like, at least try to make things a little more fair over time by doing that. Very similar to the NFL's Rooney Rule in some ways. And they hired Glanville. They didn't talk to anybody else. Like, Sam Sachs got pissed. In fact, this is our story. Sam Sachs was at Glanville's introductory press conference, which was like the last day of February. And Sam like raised his hand and he asked the question. He's like, how does it feel, you know, to be hired without the athletic department interviewing even one minority candidate on the last day of Black History Month? Didn't go over too well as far as I know. But the thing that's amazing about Sam is that like he went to work. He literally is like basically like a one-man lobbyist. And he worked with Richard Lapchick and some other people too, so it wasn't completely solo. But I think he made something like more than a dozen trips to like the state legislature, like literally face-to-face lobbying Oregon state legislatures, Republicans and Democrats, right? Being told nobody will ever go for this, asking them to pass a law that would just require the state institutions there, so not the private colleges, but the public colleges, University of Oregon, Oregon State, Portland State, where he was at, that they would just have to have like the NFL Rooney Rule. They would just have to interview at least one qualified minority candidate for any of the job openings when it comes to the coaches or administrators in the athletic departments. And he got the legislature to pass this law. And to this day, 10 years later, it is still the only state that has that law. So this is actually quite an accomplishment. And he told me something interesting. He said, you know, a lot of people told me when I did this, that I would just get ignored, that people would not be down with it, especially Republicans just wouldn't want this kind of government interference. You know, they'd look at it that way. And he said, when I went in and talked to people and explained it, by the end of every conversation, people are like, that seems totally reasonable and good. Of course we should do that. And so it's an amazing thing of like, first of all, like one person can actually still make a difference in our political system, which seems hopeless now, but it is true. Secondly, as Sam points out, this law has been effective. It is not perfect. Much like the Rooney Rule in the NFL, it is far from perfect, and we have not achieved like proportionally equal representation in these positions of power. Like we're talking about this whole conversation. Like we haven't gotten there yet, but it has made a difference. The University of Oregon has had two coaches of color, their head football coach in a row. Portland State, I believe, or the point, there's a couple other schools have had like hired more African American coaches or administrators. The names and positions are escaping me right now. I don't have a list in front of me. I'm sorry. I should, but it has made a tangible difference, and it also hasn't been something that's provoked like any backlash or people saying this is terrible. Like people seem pretty cool with it. Like they like this is a good idea. This is the right thing to do. And I think that Sam's only disappointment is that this hasn't spread to other states and it hasn't spread to the NCAA. He's personally lobbied the NCAA. Richard Lapchick and some other people have done the same thing. And the one thing that has happened is just in the last month, the West Coast Conference has also adopted the same similar rule. They call it the Bill Russell Rule after Bill Russell. So for the first time, we have a college conference getting on board with this. But the Power Five, the big boys, the NCAA, right now, we haven't seen anything yet.
So now in this moment that we're in, you know, after this kind of reawakening or awakening on race in America, You know, news early this week, or just broke yesterday. Sorry, so we're recording this on Tuesday of this week. On Monday, it was announced that Deion Sanders was going to be hired by Jackson State to go lead an HBCU. Are we going to kind of see the tide turn in this moment?
That is such a tough question to answer. I mean, it's such a big tide, and we've been waiting so long for it to turn. And we do have years where it seems to start to turn, and then we have years where it doesn't. I mean, one of the things that came out of the ASU study here was that there was a little bit of progress made over the last decade in terms of more head coaches that went out were white. There were more like sort of replacements of coaches of color. So like there's been a little bit of progress, but still the numbers are so skewed versus the number of potential coaches versus the number of, you know, almost every college coach started off as a player. And you look at the percentage of coach players of color versus not, it's not there yet. Right. So I think turning a tide actually takes a ton of time. A tide is big. It's hard to turn. You can't just get like one, even Sam Sachs, you can't get one determined surfer in that riptide and like make the whole thing turn around. You know, no one's Superman. But I do think there's an opportunity to put into place things like the Oregon law and this West Coast Conference Russell rule that over time can help shift that tide. I'm going to say shift more than turn. I think, you know, what it is, it used to be the case we could say, or not we, but like college football people could say, well, you know, there's not a lot of African-American head coaches because there's just not a lot of African-American assistants. And that was because African-American assistants were systemically shut out from even getting their foot in the door.
Or if they were allowed in the door,
right,
the primary role was recruitment.
That's exactly the other thing I learned about, which, and this is still true to this day, where like Marvin Lewis at ASU talked about this, where like, if you're even now, right? So in the old days, it was like, we basically have these unofficial quotas. Like you can have one, maybe two black assistants. They're going to be recruiters. They're basically there to keep the black players happy and not too complaining too much. And we're not really including them in the game planning, you know? So how far can you rise up to head coach? Even though recruiting is the lifeblood of college football, but you have to also be like sort of involved in game planning. That has changed a lot. It's not totally better, but that's changed a lot. But what happens now is like recruiting is so valuable. Mark Lewis explained this to me. Like if you're an African-American coach who's a really good recruiter, like you can move up the ranks in terms of getting to like better and better schools with much bigger and bigger salaries, right? The money's gone up, right? So like if you have a family and you want to have a nice life, that's pretty tempting. Like you might want to do that. You might want to go from like a small school to like, you know, Florida State or Miami or Notre Dame, wherever, right? But in doing that, you get less chance, you get more boxed into being that recruiter and less chances to sort of get involved in game planning, where if you stuck with the less paying job at the less glamorous school, it's maybe a little easier to move sideways into that now than it used to be for African Americans and coaches, other coaches of color. So there's almost like, okay, well, we're gonna open some doors of opportunity for you now, but like you're still gonna have to stay poor. It's just like that's not cool. Like we need to be able to make it so it's not like that either. But yeah, so it used to be like you could say like that's the reason we don't have all these coaches, but there are plenty of African-American coaches in the pipeline now. In fact, there are so many, they're having in the summer, these huge, Marvin Lewis is part of these, so is Fitz Hill, all these guys get together. They've been having huge Zoom calls during the pandemic. Like the rest of us are having Zoom calls, cocktail hours. Coaches of color in football are having like career cocktail hours. And these are not just hours. Like they were telling me these calls are lasting like 6, 7, 8 hours. Like guys from all the country are jumping in, jumping out. They're talking about their experiences. They're talking about what works, how to get ahead. They're guys like Marvin Lewis who have, you know, he's at ASU now. He was in the NFL for like 16, 20 years. He's giving advice to young high school African-American coaches about how to like get your resume together, how to move up, like what's a good move to make, what's not a good move to make. It was very heartening to hear about that, but it also still shows they're still having to work on these barriers, you know? White coaches aren't having to get together in 600 guy Zoom calls to figure this stuff out because you don't need to do that when you're a white coach. The system works fine for you. And I, on some ways, again, I didn't write about this. That's almost the best illustration of where we still have to get. It's like simultaneously very heartening to know that African-American coaches are doing this and incredibly frustrating to hear that they're still having to do this. Are you silent?
Yeah, no, I'm completely silent. No, it was to think of that visual.
Yeah.
Right. At some point, and Scott Brooks, who's a part of the Institute, talks about this. He's on several of these Zoom calls as well too with Black coaches. You know, all of this collective knowledge and experience that has to gather to solve this issue of barrier breaking.
Right.
When the reality is, it should be the inverse.
Exactly.
It should be the 600 other, you know, people who are in power collectively deciding together how they're going to address this issue. And in a way that is organic, not organic, is genuine.
Right.
I think a lot of what we've seen when there was the glimpse in the NFL that, yes, we are going to institute a better Rooney Rule, and this Rooney Rule would then give you competitive advantages, right? Like, it would get you more higher seating in the draft. That's just gaming the system.
That's going to produce a lot of resentment too,
right?
Which is actually, so again, this is something that I didn't get in too much of what I wrote, but I did talk to people about where, and this goes back to Fitz Hill's research, even back in the 90s and the early 2000s, where things were worse for African-American coaches than now, we have made some progress. You look at the responses he got from the Black coaches and the white coaches, and the Black coaches just were very matter-of-factly. Yeah, of course, race is still a factor in trying to get ahead in all these different ways, and they would just talk frankly about it. And these white assistants were man, Black coaches have it good. I think some of those guys just get their job because they're minorities. And actually the real discrimination is against us, the white coaches, who aren't getting the leg ahead. And it was eye-opening to see that, because I'm like, oh my God, speaking of the mirror of society, that's half our politics right now is basically the reality of people of color in America versus the grievance of some white people who don't want to sort of accept that reality and in fact feel like their reality is upside down, right? I don't think those white coaches are right in any way. None of the data supports that. The history doesn't support that. But those feelings are still real for them, right? And we do actually have to address and deal with that. So that's an important thing. You talk about those 600 people who actually are in power that make the decisions that are predominantly white. So the athletic directors, the university presidents, all that. I don't know if many of those people have those kinds of grievances, but they are still the people that need to learn about this. For them to be able to address it successfully and in a way that doesn't create more resentment or more grievance, it doesn't make Black people feel like tokens, right? To do this right, to just create more equal opportunity, which is what everybody really wants, and to sort of understand, you have to understand these barriers. You have to understand this work. You have to talk to these sociologists who have studied this. You have to understand not just how it works in college football, but how it works in employment across America. You have to understand why in corporate America there are so few executives of color. You have to understand in college athletic departments why there's so few athletic directors of color. And you have to be open to, I think personally, you have to be open to the idea, look, this isn't about whether people in the system are good, bad, racist, not racist. It's about the system and the history and the structure and how that is not making it for a level and equitable playing field. And that's where your solutions are going to come through. It's more through the structure than from the people. You can have very good-hearted and bad-hearted people. And look, in any individual employment situation, you have all sorts of reasons why people are hired and not hired. But structurally, as a whole, across the board, that's where you can put in rules and that's where you can make changes that over time, like we said, will shift the direction of that tide, of that wave. And I really think that getting white people to understand that, people who are in power to understand that, is probably the first step. Because if they don't understand it, if you don't understand a problem, how can you fix it? If you can't see the problem, if you don't think the problem is real, in fact, if you think the problem is the opposite of what the problem actually is, you're never going to get anywhere.
Patrick Hruby, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, that was Patrick Hruby, reporter for Global Sport Matters. We've put a link to his article, Too Few Black College Coaches, Too Few Opportunities, in our show notes. Also, Patrick's story is a part of our Reset of College Sport issue, which is now on our website at globalsportmatters.com. And next week on the podcast, we continue our conversation on the Reset of College Sport issue with a conversation with Daniel Libet and Luke Cyphers from the Intercollegiate. They've done reporting for us on how college athletes are using their voice in this moment to speak freely, but are being met with power and pushback. That's on next week's Global Sport Matters podcast. This episode was produced by me, Andrew Ramsamy. The Global Sport Matters podcast is a production of the Global Sport Institute at ASU. Our manager of marketing and communications is Crisal Valencia. Our manager of events and programs is Kendall Jones. Our marketing and communications assistants are Sage Piccolotti and Julia O'Connell. And our special projects assistant is Katie Cross. Until next time, I'm Andrew Ramsamy. Thank you so much for listening.